Hello everyone, welcome back. I hope you're excited for this week's Medical Halacha Chabura. Just to quickly review, as we always do, we establish how there's an isser of murder, of ritzicha. You're not allowed to murder someone, and you're also not allowed to murder someone, even if it's to save your own life, or to save someone else's life. And we establish two possible reasons. The first is that murder is so terrible, it's such a bad avera that you're not allowed to save your life. Usually you're allowed to violate averas to save your life, but when it comes to murder, you're not. Or it's because you cannot play God. You cannot say that this person's life is more valuable than this person's life, or that your life is more valuable than this person's life. Why? Because who says your blood's redder? Which we discussed two possible categories for what this means. Either it's because you are not able to determine whose life is more valuable, or by definition, everyone's life is inherently of equal value. And our question really became, okay, so you're not allowed to kill one person to save another, but are you allowed to kill one person to save the many? And last week, we discussed all the different potential reasons why it would be usser, and all the different potential reasons why it would be mutter. And now, we are going to finally analyze the trolley case itself. Because, what is the trolley case? The trolley case, the trolley problem, which we've discussed many times in the past, is a case where a trolley is going down the tracks and it's heading towards five people. It's going to kill five people. And you are by a lever, and there are many different variations of the trolley problem. There's actually a countless number of variations, but a very simple variation is that the trolley is heading towards the five people. You are by a lever. You can turn the lever and alter the direction of the trolley, but now it will go towards an innocent worker on the side and will kill one person. So can you actively pull the lever to redirect the trolley towards that one person and kill that one person? Or should you be passive and allow the trolley to kill the five? Now, we basically have to go through the same exact process that we went last week when it comes to are you allowed to kill the one to save the many, and go through each of our two approaches, our two frameworks. So the first one is chumras havera, that the reason why you're not allowed to kill one person to save another is because of chumras havera, because the avera is so bad. Because usually you're allowed to violate an avera to save another person because of a chai behem, because Hashem created the mitzvahs for you to live by them, connect with Him, live a spiritual life, accomplish your purpose in this world, but that doesn't allow you to violate the big three, which includes murder. Now, the question really became, are there any exceptions? Is the chumras havera something which is all-encompassing, or do we say that there are exceptions, such as to save the many? Now, our question needs to be twofold. Is the trolley problem a case of chumras havera? And even if it is chumras havera, we discussed previously last week that there's still potential to say that it's mutter. But we want to really assess it from the approach of finding out exactly where the trolley problem lies in our analysis. Is it the classical case of chumras havera? Because what is the trolley problem? What are you doing when you are pulling the lever? You are, in essence, deciding to kill one to save the many. And we're not going to go back into what's defined as the many, because we'll just allow five workers to fit the category of the many, even though it might have to be more, it might have to be 10, 100, all of Klal Yisrael. We're not going to get into the nitty-gritty details of what's considered to be the Rabbim, but we'll assume that these five workers classify as the Rabbim. So now, this would generally be considered a case of murder, and it would therefore be prohibited. But there are some ameliorating factors that must be taken into account. And that's really what we're going to be doing now, is we're going to be going through a bunch of possible reasons to suggest why this might not be chumras havera. So the first possibility is that it might be a grama. It might be, what's a grama? Grama is when there's an indirect action. So Halacha does classify certain actions as grama, or indirect. And just to give some examples, the Rambam, he puts this in the Mishnah Torah, that someone who locks a prisoner in a room and doesn't feed him, he didn't actively kill him. He performed no, you know, he didn't actively do any action that ends this person's life, but you are indirectly killing him, because the lack of food is what eventually kills him. And so it's a result of you locking him up that he's going to die. The Rambam, you can look this Rambam up in Hilchos Ritzeach, in Hilchos Ritzeach Shemiras HaNefesh, in Perek Beis, Halacha Beis. And in the trolley case too, you can argue that you're not directly killing the individual worker. Did you throw anything at him, stab him, shoot him? You didn't do anything direct. What are you doing? You are pulling a lever and that lever is going to redirect the trolley in his direction. So the train is performing the actual act of murder. All you're doing is redirecting it. Now, you could definitely say that this is a similar argument to the argument people say that people don't kill people, guns kill people. But it is a little different, because in the case of a gun, the shooter is creating the initial force of the weapon. By pulling the trigger, you are literally sending the weapon in motion. In the trolley case, the weapon's already moving. And the bystander, what you are doing is you're redirecting the weapon, which is already in movement. So you could argue that's different. So it is very possible this case may not be a grommet. You could still say that, because the act of murder is still somewhat direct. And we're not going to do this now, but you have to really analyze the sugya of grommet, because what is grommet? So people will define grommet as indirect. But if you look, go learn Baba Kama, go learn the sugyas of grommet, what does it take to be a grommet? Is it only indirect? Does there have to be a time delay? How long of a time delay is enough of a time delay? So for example, when you're pulling the trolley lever, within a couple seconds, the trolley is going to hit him. So how much of a time delay is that? Does there have to be an external force committing the act? What do I mean? What's the classic example, traditional example of grommet? Not grommet of Ritzicha, just classic grommet. Classic case of grommet is when you open the gate, the pen, of an animal pen, and the sheep, the animals, they subsequently exit. So in such a case, there was both a time delay, because you opened the gate and that didn't cause the animals to, it didn't cause the owner to lose the animals. The animals were still in there when you opened the gate. But at a certain point in time, the animals left the pen of their own volition. So if you look at that case, there's two aspects. One is that there is a time delay. And the other is that the sheep are leaving of their own volition. There's another force that is involved in the hefsed, in the loss, and whatever is going on here. So you can suggest that in the trolley case, there's a time delay, and there's also an outside force. The trolley possesses its own force. But you can also say that, number one, the time delay is not significant. Why? Because the bystander is pulling the lever, and the worker is going to die like immediately, a couple seconds. So is that enough? Because it's not immediately direct. How immediate does the impact have to be? And the second question which we can challenge is this really an outside force? Maybe when the bystander, when you pull the lever, you are taking ownership and control of the trolley's force and movement and all of that, the trajectory is now basically in your control, and you are taking control over that trajectory. Maybe that force now becomes your force when you pull the lever. Now it's similar to someone who shoots a gun. You can't say it's some outside force. Now, I didn't want to get too much into this, because you can also suggest that grommet doesn't require both a time delay and an external force. You can say it only requires a time delay or only an external force. Or you can say that it requires either a time delay or an external force. We're not going to get into the nitty-gritty, but regardless, this topic does require more discussion, and it is beyond the scope of what we're trying to accomplish here. I just want to kind of put out there the idea that grommet, number one, is a potential ameliorating factor. It can get us out of the problem of chumas avera. And number two, it's not so pashut this is a grommet. We have to discuss what grommet is. But now let's question, why do we want to use grommet here? Why do we want to say maybe this case of the trolley problem is a grommet? Because if it's a grommet, and grommet is a way of saying it's not so bad, because grommet, we will see how grommet, in some sense, will make something less severe, and we're going to really challenge what exactly does the grommet do to an act in just a moment. But we'll argue that if you want to say that this is considered a grommet, now what does grommet do to the status of the prohibition? So let's say this is ritzicha, but it's not really ritzicha because it's a grommet of ritzicha. You're not murdering them, you're just causing an eventual murder. It's not direct, it's indirect. So one second, what does the grommet do? If you kill the grommet, so is this no longer an eser of ritzicha? Is this ritzicha begrommet, or is this not even ritzicha at all? Meaning, and this, remember, we're going to have to understand how to categorize this. Is this murder begrommet, or is this not murder at all? Is it a less severe version of murder? And therefore, I mean, here's the way that to categorize this. Number one is that Ritzicha Begrama is literally still Ritzicha. It doesn't help you. Number two is that Ritzicha Begrama is still murder, but it's not as severe. Ah, so that can get you out of Chumros Aveira, maybe. Because you can say that, okay, it still categorizes murder, but it's not such a severe form of murder. So maybe now I wouldn't be, I would be allowed to violate to save life. Maybe even one person's life. Forget the many, maybe even one person's life. But you can also question, maybe it's no longer murder at all. Now, what would be the reason to say that it's murder but less severe? You can argue that maybe Ritzicha Begrama, you're not Chayiv Misa. So if you're not Chayiv Misa, maybe the reason you're not Chayiv Misa is because it's no longer, either it's no longer murder or it's just not a severe form of murder. And therefore, if you recall, when it comes to abortion, we had a whole question on the nature and categorization of abortion, because you're not Chayiv Misa for abortion. You're not Chayiv for killing a fetus. You're not Chayiv Misa for killing treifin. You're not Chayiv Misa for killing like a lot of these types of categories, like even the Nafel. So the question really becomes, why aren't you Chayiv Misa for killing a treifin? Why aren't you Chayiv Misa for killing a fetus? One option is because these are not cases of resicha. These aren't murder. The other option is that they are murder, but they're not the type of murder which is as severe as regular murder, either because they're not considered to be a full life. So treifa, remember, someone who's going to die within a year. And a goses also, the Rambam holds a goses is your chayim misa if you kill a goses. That's someone who's on their deathbed. Literally, the Gemara says that, you know, identifies them as someone who's going to die within 3 days, and if you touch them, they'd likely die. So someone who's on their deathbed. Nowadays, the halachic status of a goses is unclear. Who has the status of a goses? When? And what, like, if you're in a vegetative state, what's your halachic status? But let's say, just according to the shittos, let's say you are not chayiv misa for killing a goses. So same thing, is it because it's not murder, or is it because it is murder, but it's not as severe as killing a full-fledged human being? Same thing for a fetus. Rav Moshe Feinstein holds that a fetus is an iser v'tzicha if you kill a fetus. Abortion is an iser v'tzicha. And the reason we're not chayiv misa is because it's not a full-fledged v'tzicha. It's not the same as a full-fledged human being, but it's still a nefesh, it's still alive. Many poskim hold that it's not v'tzicha. And if you go back to our first year, we really went into that in great depth. But the question becomes, in terms of categorization, how do we categorize this? So now, if we go back to the trolley case, perhaps Grama eliminates the Isser of Ritzicha altogether. And therefore, because there's no Isser of Ritzicha, you'd be allowed to redirect the trolley. Or you can say that the Isser of Ritzicha remains. And you can say, like the Ramban and the Ran state, that you're not allowed to violate the prohibition of murder because of the severity, chumras of it. Remember, that was what we suggested. So maybe that no longer applies. Even if Ritzicha is there, the chumra of Ritzicha is not there. You can also suggest that even if the Grama doesn't prevent the violation of the Vera, that it would take away the severity. That's basically what we're saying. So it would be a less severe form of murder. You have to balance it, because you could say, no, that doesn't matter. Even if it's less severe, even if it's not Chayiv Misa, it's a less severe form of murder, it still would be Aser. So I don't want you guys to get too confused. Basically, you can simplify it by saying that Grama will do something to Ritzicha, and the question is it enough to get rid of the Chumras Avira? Does it knock out the Avira completely? Does it knock off enough that it's no longer a chumras avera of Ritzicha, or is that not significant? As long as the Isser of Ritzicha is there, it's chumra enough, that it's bad enough, it's strict enough, that you would still have to give up your life rather than do this, even if it's to save the many. The second potential ameliorating factor in the case of the trolley problem would be our ability to classify the single worker on the side as a rodev. And this sounds ambitious. Why? Because a rodev, if you go back to our second shir where we talked about rodev, second shir in this chabura series, a rodev is classified as a pursuer, someone who's attempting to cause someone else harm. And usually we classify a rodev as someone who's trying to kill someone else. So The single worker on the side who's tied down, you're going to classify him as a rodif. Why? Because you'd say that he is potentially preventing you from saving these five workers. And because he's preventing you from saving these five workers, since, you know, his death is in the way, he is somewhat indirectly causing these five workers to die. It's a jump. So what's the classic source for Rodef? Classic source for Rodef is the Mishnah on Sanhedrin, and Daf Ein Gimel Amud Aleph, which states that if an assailant is rising up to kill someone, then it's permissible to kill that assailant first. And permissible, a mitzvah, it's a whole machlokas, we're not going to go into it. But the question really is whether the assailant has to have explicit intent, kavana, to harm the victim, or just the fact that he is his situation is causing harm, that's what can make him a rodef. Meaning, does a rodef have to have intent? So this is really important because this single worker has no intent. And many, many, many commentators believe that you have to have intent to be a rodef. There are some Rishonim, there are definitely some commentators who believe that even if you don't have Kavana, you can still be a Rodef. So for example, the Rambam in Hilchos Ritzeach, which we mentioned in one of our earlier Shirim also, in that second Shir, in Hilchos Ritzeach, in the first parak, Halachatas, he maintains that a fetus is considered a Rodef if it presents harm to the mother, even though the fetus clearly has no intent to do anything harmful. Now, we did mention possibilities of that not being as pashut as it seems. As in, does the Rambam hold that a fetus is a full nefesh, and therefore the only reason why you'd be able to kill the fetus to save the mother is because of Rodef? That's what Moshe Feinstein holds. Or does the Rambam hold that the fetus is not really a nefesh, and therefore you would be allowed to kill the fetus to save the mother? And then the question everyone asks is, why does he classify the fetus as a rodef? The only reason you need to classify the fetus as a rodef is to give a potential reason why you'd be allowed to kill the fetus to save the mother. But if the fetus is not a nefesh, then it doesn't need to be a rodef. So what is the Rambam saying? So everyone who thinks that the fetus is not a nefesh wants to get the Rambam on their side, so they have to give some explanation for why the fetus is considered to be a rodef. Why he thinks that's the only reason that you're allowed to kill the rodef to save the mother. So there are a couple really nice shitas out there. Some cuter, some like, you know, much more lumdish. Some of the cuter ones is that, I don't mean cute isn't like that lumdish, I mean like more technical. So for example, there is one shita that says that the reason why the Rambam classifies it like this is to teach you in terms of payment. That usually when it comes to the Gemara in Baba Kama says that the fetus belongs to the father and the fetus has monetary value. So usually when it comes to when you damage something, when you cause some monetary harm in order to save your life, you have to pay them back. The only exception is when it's a rodef. So the Rambam brings down la halacha that if you're on a ship and the ship is going down at sea, you're allowed to throw everything off the ship in order to save yourself, and you do not need to repay whoever those belongings belong to because those belongings were rodef. Now, were they a rodef? No. The belongings don't have intent. They're a bunch of crates, they're boxes, whatever they are. But it means that they have the status of the cause of harm, and since they inherit the status of a rodef as being the cause of harm, it gets the status of you don't have to pay them back. So we're not talking about rodef in terms of like chayiv misa or in terms of heter etzicha. We're talking about rodef in terms of just the cause of harm. And therefore, so too, if you kill the fetus to save your life, you do not need to repay the father, since the fetus had the status of a rodef in terms of the fact that it was the cause of the harm to the mother. That's why you're allowed to do that. That's one beautiful, I mean, when I say cute, it's still a beautiful shita. It's, well, you'll just see that there are some more fundamental shitas. So there's another shita that says, why is the Rambam put it specifically here? Why is he considered a rodef? Because if you look at the previous halacha, the Rambam just mentioned that when it comes to a rodef, the first thing you should do is try to maim him. So let's say a person is trying to kill you. You don't kill the rodef. The first thing you try to do is stop him. So run away. Or if you can't run away, then maim him. Shoot him in the leg. Cut off his arm. tackle him, hurt him, but don't kill him first. Only if you can't kill him, then, sorry, only if you can't stop him without killing him, then you should kill him. So there's a huge discussion whether this also applies to the person who is being chased. So for example, let's say you are being chased by a Rodef. You, the person being chased, are allowed to kill the Rodef, and someone else, a third party who sees this, is also allowed to kill the Rodef. Now, the question is, this halacha of don't kill him first, try to stop him first, does it apply to both the person being chased and the third party, or only the third party who has more of a sense of calm, because he's not the one in danger, but the person who's being chased doesn't have to go through that extra calculation and say, can I stop him, or am I able to kill him straight? That person is able to kill him straight because he's in sakana, he doesn't have to think it through. So why does the Rambam put this halacha right before the halacha of killing the fetus to save the mother right after that? To teach you the same principle. Because what does the Mishnah Olo say explicitly? It doesn't say you can kill the fetus to save the mother. It says if the fetus is harming the mother, then you are able to pull out the fetus limb by limb. And this approach, as Achron suggests, that the reason why the Rambam specifically says you're allowed to pull out the fetus limb by limb and connects it to Rodef is because it's the same halacha. If you don't have to kill the fetus and you can maim the fetus by doing whatever you have to do in order to save the mother's life, do that first. Only if the only way you could save the mother is by killing the fetus are you allowed to kill the fetus. But the same way that you should try to minimize the harm without taking away the life of the Rodef, same way, minimize the harm without killing the fetus. That's another beautiful shita. A really just beautiful Lundish approach that we discussed in that second shiur, which is given by Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim suggests as follows. He suggests that the reason why the Rambam says that it's a rodef is because a rodef, there are two aspects of a rodef. One is a rodef and the other is a nirdef. A rodef is the person who's trying to kill the nirdef. The nirdef is the one being chased. The reason why you can kill a rodef is because he has the status of a rodef, and the other is that you're trying to save the nirdef. So normally you need to have both. You need to be saving you need to be saving the nirdef, and you have to be trying to get the rodef. When it comes to the fetus, there's no real rodef because the fetus is not really trying to kill the mother, but you do have a nirdef because the mother is in danger because of the fetus. So you basically have a really peculiar situation of a nirdef without a rodef. And we have a nirdef without a rodef, you're not allowed to kill a person to save the mother. So for example, the Gemara says that once the head of the fetus comes out, where the robe of the body of the fetus comes out, it's the Gemara in Sanhedrin Daf Ayin Beis Amud Beis, that you are no longer allowed to kill the child once the child's born. Until then, you are. So what does Rav Chaim say? Chedush Rav Chaim al Rambam says in Hilchos Rotzeach Perek Aleph Halacha Tes on this Rambam. He says that the reason is because while the fetus is in the womb, the fetus is not yet a full nefesh, and therefore it only has. And therefore, it has the unique status that this situation of just having a nirdaf without a rodef is enough to sacrifice the fetus to save the mother. As in, this problem of it being the cause of a nirdaf without it being a rodef is enough that you can sacrifice it to kill the mother. Once it's born, however, and now full nefesh, now you need both a nirdaf and a rodef. And therefore, it's not okay. Now, just recall, just go back. Well, we'll go back in 1 second. We'll just quickly say that back to other situations where just having a nirdaf is enough, where you don't need to have kavana to be a rodef. The Vilna Gaon says, he says in Chosh and Mishpat, and you can see in 425 in Sifkatan Yud Aleph, that he also holds that a person can be considered a rodef without intent. And he's not talking about necessarily the same type of case. He's talking about a case where you can look at it inside. It's talking about a slightly different case. It might not be as applicable, but the concept is there of being a rodef without having intent. And if you want to argue this, then you can say that when it comes to a single worker, he can be considered to be a rodef even though he doesn't have intent, and therefore you would be allowed to kill him to save the five, because it's not about intent. It's about, you can say, a more consequentialist, more Like, he is, at the end of the day, it's because of him that these five people will die, and therefore you can classify him as a Roy Davis. It's difficult. It's tough. I would say the natural logician, the natural rationalist would say, like, I don't like that argument. I don't think he's the cause of danger. I think it's an unfortunate situation. But to the extent to which this worker causes the other's harm, it really is so indirect that it may not be enough to classify him as Rodif, like I was just saying. And it appears that, if you ask me, that the trolley is the cause of death, not the single worker. So it really is questionable if you can compare him to a harmful fetus who at least is... Here's the thing. Neither the worker nor the fetus has intent. And at the end of the day, the fetus at least is more directly involved causing the danger to the mother. It doesn't have intent, but it's physically, you know, up against the mother. The worker is literally off on the side, which I think is an important point. Now, I just want to take one step back and to briefly say something which I think is so important, which is that the question of whether or not a Rodif requires intent is very much connected to the reason of why you are permitted to kill a Rodif. So we discussed this in that second shiur, but according to those who think that the heter to kill Rodif is either because the Rodif is chayv misa, like we saw the Ran holds this in Sanhedrin, defining Bezim and Aleph, then it would be quite logical to assume that you have to have intent to attain the status of chayv misa. And also, if you think that the reason why you're allowed to kill the Rodif is to save the Rodif from the avir of murder, which is the shita of Rashi and the Yad Ramah on Sanhedrin, Daf Ayin Gimel and Aleph, then also the Rodif would have to have intent. Because otherwise the avira is not, it might not even be there, but definitely won't be as severe. But if you think that the heter to kill Rodif is because of saving the nirdaf, like we just said, it's all about the nirdaf, then to save the one being pursued, you might not need the intent of a Rodif. It might not be as important. You could argue that, no, you still need the intent of a Rodif, because that's the only way that you're allowed to kill the Rodif to save the nirdaf, because otherwise it's not enough. But because, and when we talk about Hatzal and Nirdaf, the focus is not really on the Rodif status, it's on the Nirdaf being saved. He's the one in danger. And we saw the Yad Ramah and Sanhedrin Ayin Gimel Aleph, the Minchas Chinuch. If you look at Reish Tzadi Hey, Reish Tzadi Vav, also the Rambam and Hilchas Ritzeach in the first Perek Halacha Vav. There's a lot of interesting Torah in that. Also, you should also see that Chiddush Yochai Malevi. So there really is a lot of discussion here, and we have to, I will tell you that there's some interesting shitos when it comes to this case, and we're not going to get too much into it now because it's going to complicate a little bit, but you should also just go back to that shiur and hear of Moshe's approach as to why the Rambam thinks that you are allowed to kill the fetus as a Rodif, even though technically, if you think that you don't need intent to be a Rodif, why is the fetus any more of a Rodif than the mother? Right? Because the mother should also be a Rodif. The fetus is in danger because of the mother. So you can either say that the mother is not a Rodif, or you can argue that the mother has a different relationship with the fetus, or you can argue that they're both a Rodif, but since the mother is a full nefesh and the fetus is not a full nefesh, therefore the fetus is a bigger Rodif, because the fetus is a Rodif after a full nefesh and the mother is a Rodif after not a full nefesh. Of Moshe Feinstein holds that in that case the bigger Rodif is Mevatel, the smaller Rodif, so now only the fetus becomes the Rodif, which is a huge chiddush, and he uses that to understand the Gemara Yerushalmi, which we will discuss soon. I don't want to really lose you here, but I just wanted to kind of show you that the general framework of why you'd even think that the Rodif gains, why this single worker gains a status of a Rodif. It would only be if you really focus on the Nirdaf and the five workers being in danger and not really focus on the intent and the involvement of the single worker. So the third possibility, beyond the issue of Rodifa being a Rodif beyond Grama, is intent. Meaning what? Meaning that the worker we know doesn't have any bad intent, doesn't have any bad kavana, he's not trying to be a Rodif. He might be a Rodif, but we can also say from another perspective that the bystander has no desire to kill the individual worker. Meaning what? That if there was an alternative way of saving these five workers that did not risk the individual worker's life, the bystander, you who are on the side, would surely take it. Right? And if the worker, let's say you pulled the lever and the trolley went towards the single worker, and the single worker somehow managed to loosen the ropes and roll out of the trolley's trajectory, you would be overjoyed. The single worker's death represents an unintended result, one which the bystander doesn't want and would greatly regret if it happened. So there is a famous Christian philosopher, St. Thomas Aquinas, who posited the notion of the double effect principle. We're going to use this because Rav Moshe Feinstein, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, a lot of posts can hold by a very similar principle. I just want to kind of flesh out what the idea is. So it's basically also called the doctrine double effect. So within this theory, within this system, there are certain actions that have negative consequences, but they're permitted as long as there are a few conditions. Number one, the act itself has to be defined as good. Number two is that the person has to have pure intentions in performing this action. Number three, there must be no alternative method of achieving this positive effect, what you're trying to accomplish. And number four, the good must exceedingly outweigh the bad. So in regards to the trolley case, you have all four. Why? Because pulling the lever conforms to each of these criteria in the following way. Number one, when you pull the lever as the bystander, you are executing a life-saving act. That means that, what's number one? The act has to be good. You're saving a life. Number two, your intention is only to save the five workers. What was number two? You have to have good intentions, pure intentions. Number three, you have no alternative method of saving these five workers. That was number three. There has to be no alternative method of achieving your wanted result. And number four, the lives of these five workers, assumedly, are greater than the value of the individual life. And that was number four, is that the good must exceedingly outweigh the bad. Now, you can argue on each of these, but basically, you would suggest that under such extenuating circumstances, you would be able to do something that would have otherwise been usur, been prohibited. So we find this in halacha as well. Halacha, where do we find this? So Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, when they write in their tshuvas, when it comes to, and actually Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, it's actually brought down in Nishmas Avraham, not in Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's actual own works, but brought down b'shem Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, that when it comes to end of life care, it's a complicated and controversial field of medicine, and one of the issues that they have to deal with is the issue of pain relief at the end of life. So many people unfortunately struggle with extreme pain towards the end of their lives. So in order to relieve this pain, a doctor might administer morphine. But morphine can make breathing more difficult, can therefore hasten death. So this situation becomes a trade-off between, number one, you have significant pain, but if you want to relieve that pain, there would be a potential threat to life. So Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rav Moshe Feinstein both permit doctors to administer controlled amounts of morphine as long as the sole intent is of relieving the patient's pain, for the same exact logic, right? This is basically the logic of double effect. Yes, there might be an unwanted result, right? Assumably the doctor fully intends to help the patient, number one, good intent, doesn't want to hasten the death, right? No intent to do anything bad. He's administering something which is potentially harmful, but the purpose is to alleviate the pain, and it's medicine. So you consider it an act of eliminating pain, not of harming the patient. You can define it as something good because the intent is really to do something good. There might be some unwanted results, but once again, that's not something you really want. So there is still a reason to question this. Well, what's the reason to question this principle? Is that it still is hard to justify murder or harm based on pure intention. A person is responsible, you can argue, for the consequences of his or her actions, regardless of whether you intended or didn't intend for something to occur, especially if you know it's going to happen. So there's a very famous, often discussed case called the dynamite case, where a group of friends are stuck in a cave after a fat man became stuck in the only exit to the cave. And water began flowing into the cavern. So in a few minutes, everyone in this cavern, everyone in the cave is going to have drowned and died. So Luckily, as there always is in these types of stories, there's one man who has a stick of dynamite and a match. And if he blows up the fat man, everyone in the cave can escape quite quickly. And if not, everyone's going to die. So what should you do? So you can argue that perhaps according to the doctrine of double effect, according to what we just said, that you would not be allowed to blow up the fat man because your intention here is to kill him and therefore be immortal, be usur. You're trying to blow him up. So you could say, and this is Philippe Foot, who was one of the, really made trolleyology, made the whole trolley problem go famous. She was one of the, really one of the founders of this, you know, what made this question really skyrocket in terms of popularizing it. But she suggests a simple counterargument. What she says, she says, listen, this man, you don't have to say that you intended to kill the famine. You can argue that you only wanted to break him into pieces, many pieces, a thousand, a million pieces, so that everyone else could escape the cave. Now, if you're going to argue that morality depends heavily on intent, then you can say there's a justification to blow the famine, because you didn't intend to kill him, you just wanted to move him. Move him in a bunch of different pieces away. Now, like, this path of logic is obviously absurd, because you can easily say that the intention is not as significant when the consequences of your actions are so clear. This is ipsi gratia. Like, it's definitely going to happen. And you can argue that there's different types of intentions, different types of wants. You can say that, listen, I want to eat ice cream, but I don't want, I have no intention of, you know, gaining weight by eating ice cream every single day. But, like, it doesn't really matter. If something is so clearly going to happen when you do it, you can argue that it becomes your intention, even if you can argue and say that's not my abstract intention. So that's really the question. So if you maintain that you're not allowed to blow up the fat man because the dynamite is definitely going to result in this fat man's death, you still could form a clear distinction, though, between this case and the trolley case. Why? Because in this case, the fat man has to die. The fat man has to die in order for everyone else to be saved. But in the case of the trolley, the bystander does not intend for the man to even be hit by the train, let alone die. And if the single worker manages somehow in time himself and survive, he'd be overjoyed. And he doesn't have to die in order for the five people to be saved. It's not a prerequisite. And you can argue that, okay, fine, you can say you don't intend for the fat... You'd be more than happy if the fat man got out of the way from the dynamite. True, but there's no time for that to happen. Like, practically, once the dynamite explodes, the fat man in the cave will die. But once the trolley is turned, there is some time, there's some space between the trolley turning and it hitting the single worker, and you can argue that that's enough to say that you do not want it to happen, and you can try to argue for that doctrine double effect. The last option, so far what do we have? We have intention, we have rodef, and we have grama. The last option is defining the act as a maisa hatzol, as a life-saving act. It's about how you define the actual maisa itself. That's how we're trying to get out of chumas avira. So this last option is for minimizing the severity action, is basically trying to think of how halacha defines a given act. So when you isolate this act, can it be defined as something other than an act of murder? Can we potentially define it as an act of saving the five workers, not an act of murdering the one worker? Is it one? Is it the other? Is it both? So let's say you're an outsider, and you're unaware of this single worker tied to this divergent track, and you saw the trolley situation being played out. So wouldn't you praise the man for pulling the lever? Because you're saving these five people. So yes, it's true, there's someone on the side who's going to be killed, but you could view this as an act of saving with unfortunate repercussions. So it's basically one of these questions of how do we view an act that has multiple repercussions. So it's something which is, we're not going to really discuss this so much now, but this is, you have this concept appear in other places. For example, if you've ever heard the sugya of kimla midrapne, something which I think we have mentioned before, it's that when you violate two Torah prohibitions, you're only culpable for the more severe of the two punishments. So if you murder someone, and in doing so you also damage the victim's clothing or property, then Beis Din will only make you culpable, you only have to be responsible for the murder, not for the monetary damages. And if you look at the different sugyas in Makos and then different places appear like Gemara, his question is that only when it comes to murder and money. What about Makos? What about Ritzicha and Makos? What about Makos and Mammon? Lashes and money. But there are several ways to understand why when you murder someone and you also cause them monetary damage, you only get the punishment for the murder. So one is that the more severe punishment, your chayiv misa for murdering someone, that chayiv misa includes the lesser of the punishments in it as well. The second option is that the more severe punishment knocks out the lesser one. So it's not that you're supposed to get both, but you only get one. It's that there is only one now because the chayiv misa knocks out the chayiv of tashlumin, of paying back for the money. Number three is that, listen, you really are responsible for both, but Beis Din, the Jewish court, can only bestow a single punishment at a time. And therefore, since they can only create one punishment, we only chayiv to do the chayiv misa, not for the chayiv tashlum of the mammon. And one of the real classic sugyas is that there is, Rashi quotes this in the Gemara, that there is still this concept of paying him back. That it's like, you know, it's a nice thing. And the question is it really... Is it lifnim mishuros hadin? Is it something which is that you really don't have to do at all? Like there's no chiyuv, but it's nice to give the money? Or no, is there really a chiyuv there, but Beis Din just can't make you, can't enforce that chiyuv? And therefore, really there is something genuine there that you really should be paying back, but just Beis Din can't make you do it. And the last option, which is the one most relevant to the trolley case, is that, listen, when you kill someone, and there's also monetary damage there, Beis Din can only define the prohibited act in one way. So is this defined as an act of murder, or is this defined as an act of monetary damage, of nezikin? So the rule is that Beis Din has to define the act in one way. And there are interesting cases where, let's say, the chayiv mammon is created at a different time than the actual time of the act of murder. So the moment of the act is one act, so to speak, meaning that's when you're chayiv misa. But let's say, for example, knas. Knas is something that's created in Beis Din. So let's say you killed someone, and with that murder, there's also a knas involved. So can the knas be added on? Because knas, the chiyuv of the knas is created separately at a different point in time. So you can argue whether that knas is created in Beis Din, but it's building off of the Shas HaMaisa, when the actual Maisa occurred, or if it's a complete creation in Beis Din. But the point is that once Beis Din is defining the act, it has to define it one way, it has to be defined in one way, if you ignore the whole knas variable. So similarly, when it comes to a trolley problem, you can suggest that when there is this act of saving and an act of murder, you have to define it in one way. So maybe we can define it as an act of saving, since maybe you can argue that it's more of an act of saving than an act of murder, perhaps because of the numbers. So the Chazon Ish brings down in many of his works, and actually a couple places, he says that he uses this reasoning, and he says when discussing basically an identical case, well, what's the case that he's discussing? He's discussing a case where an arrow is shot towards a crowd of people, and it's going to kill many of them. So it's probably easier to think of it as a grenade heading towards the masses, or a bus heading towards a crowd. But while this is happening, a bystander could be capable of knocking the arrow or the grenade or the bus, whatever this dangerous thing is, you can knock it away. And it would then hit a single person who's standing to the side. And basically, the Chazon Ish gives his opinion on what's basically the trolley problem. He says that maybe you would be able to do this since we can define it as a Maisa Hatzol, an act of saving. So if you look at the Chazon Ish in Choser Mishpat, in Sanhedrin, in Simon Chafhei, and also in his Chedushim Yoradea, and in Samach Tas. You can also look at Sitz Eliezer, and the Shukei Chamed, and many other sources, Sefer Shirin Lerofei. But you can basically say, listen, the dynamite case is different. Because, why is it different? Because in that case, the act itself is blowing up an innocent man. But so the intentions might be altruistic, but the act itself is indisputably evil. And isolating the action clarifies that it's an act of murder. What did you do? You did an act of blowing up the dynamite, which killed this fat man. But When it comes to our case, you might be able to isolate the act and say that the isolated act is a kind act. It's an act of hatzalah, an act of saving. Now, to be very fair, the Chazanish himself questions this because he says that might be true from the five workers' perspective, that it's an act of saving, but from the single worker's perspective, it is a straightforward act of murder. Because the bystander has taken a runaway train that was diverted, that was heading towards five people, and basically has simply diverted it, hurtling down the track towards him, and to end his life. So you could definitely argue, oh, it's a maisa atzola when you look at it from one perspective. It's a maisa ritzicha when you look at it from a different perspective. So he does conclude that Besafik is in doubt, and he questions whether you can really objectively define this as an act of saving. So that was basically all within Chumash Aveir, within the perspective that the reason why you are not allowed to divert the train down towards the single worker is because of Chumash Aveir, you're not allowed to sacrifice the few to save the many. We argued maybe it wasn't such a bad act. Maybe it wasn't such a Chumash Aveir, either because of there was, it's a grama, or because of Rodef, or because of intent, or because you can define it as a Maisa Hatzala. But what about our second approach, which is that the reason why you are not allowed to kill someone to save someone else, or even to save the many, is because you're not allowed to play God. So there are several factors to consider about why I'd be mutter here as well. Why? So number one is that when it comes to the value of life. So the trolley problem is a question of sacrificing one life to save five. So the original case the Gemara dealt with is basically one for one, sacrificing one to save the one. So we argued already that when it comes to sacrificing one person to save another, the Gemara rules that you cannot know whose life is more valuable. And therefore, you cannot sacrifice one to save another. But we argue it's possible that in cases like the trolley problem, where you have the ability to save five lives, that may override the life of the one. You may be able to kill one to save the many. You could say that the value of many lives is more valuable than the value of one. And that's because, you know, for whatever reason, we do assume that you'll live longer, five will longer than one. We do assume that you'll perform mitzvahs when it's more people. We do assume that there'll be more tzidkus and level of righteousness, or that the value of five souls is more valuable than one. It's possible. And there are definitely reasons to reject this as well. And we basically said that you can definitely say that you can never know whose life is more valuable, and no matter how many the number is quantitatively, everyone is no matter if equal value, or we just don't know who's more valuable, you can't play God. We put that out there already. Another possibility, though, is that if we argue the principle of Rodef, meaning if we said that a single worker can be considered the cause of the other's death, even though it's indirectly, even though there's no kavana, you could argue that you would be allowed to sacrifice this person's life since he's defined as a Rodef, as long as the Rodef doesn't require intent. So we already stated, though, just a couple minutes ago, that many people require intent to be a Rodef. And it's definitely a far stretch to claim that the single worker is really a Rodef and the source of danger. So it's much more likely that either the trolley is the, you know, quote-unquote Rodef, or that there's no Rodef here. And to be very honest, the other factors that we listed above are not really as relevant to this approach, because they really only serve to downplay the severity of the act and the chumras havira. But this approach is not really concerned with the chumras havira. It's concerned about you choosing whose life to save, you playing God. So the concept of groma and the level of intent and defining the act as an act of saving are not really as relevant. And so basically we will end today's shiur at this point, where we basically, given the possible reasons why it would be mutter to pull the lever, either because it's not chumras havira, because of all the ideas we mentioned, or because there's no issue of playing God, either because the lives of the many are more valuable, or because you have the principle of Rodef. And we also mentioned all the reasons why it potentially would not be allowed, despite the fact that you have all of these possible reasons. And in next week's sheet, we'll continue this, and very soon, either next week or the week after that, we will finally be able to apply this to self-driving cars, and then we'll be able to move on to our next topic. I hope you have an amazing week. I hope you enjoyed this week's Chabura, and I cannot wait until next week's Chabura. Have an amazing week.